Author of the Week with Alex Lefchuk and, of course, another sensationally talented purveyor of perfect prose.
But who's the author?
Let's find out.
2006, four key myths were actually entered into the joys of literature and indeed duly taken apart. Myth number one, curry was originally designed to disguise rotten meat in hot countries. Myth buster, if that's the case, why didn't the Arab and African countries also invent curry? Myth number two, the hotter the curry is, the better it is. No, Indians do not eat hot curries. Authentic curry is made to taste the spices and herbs. Myth number three, curry is a sort of stew with curry powder in it. Mythbuster, authentic Indian recipes require hours of cooking, and normally in any one home, one dish is prepared on any given day. Myth number four, curry creates dyspepsia. Garlic, ginger, turmeric, cloves, cinnamon are regarded as essential ingredients in traditional curry, which help to promote good health and digestion, unlike chili powder-based hot curries. And not my words, but the words of the awesome writer and scholar Kadeem Hussain in his text from 2006, Going for a Curry, A Social and Culinary History. Kadeem, welcome to Author of the Week. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Excellent. Now, it was Rob Nichols, who's also with us, who drew my attention specifically to this text, which was endorsed by Ashok Kumar, of course, and indeed specifically looks to how the curry in particular has got a wonderful history going all the way back to Queen Victoria and before, even the Romans, arguably, by view in terms of spices. But Rob, what were your thoughts on this connection specifically with respect to Middlesbrough and the curry?
That Kadeem had explored a subject that's close to all of our stomachs as well as our hearts. And I'd taken Middlesbrough into the culinary world. And I suppose it's something that we've always taken for granted. And he's busted so many myths, hasn't he? Really has. And I was astonished by that.
Well, exactly. I mean, Kadeem, obviously you have this has been a passion, I think, for your good self. Talk to us about why you came up with the idea and why, in particular, you were interested in terms of how the curry evolved and also the first restaurants in Middlesbrough, because there's a little bit of uncertainty in terms of what the first restaurant would have actually been. But I'm intrigued by, obviously, everything from the Paradise onwards and, of course, your own involvement in setting up and being responsible for the establishment of the Cleveland Tandoori.
Well, yeah, it's quite interesting. That by accident, I used to work for ICI in research, very cushy job. And I was made redundant. I was one of the first ones to go on the back, be made redundant. And the idea was they were going to cut down staff, but I knew it was coming. The fact that, you know, once you start shutting down research, it was going to go. I was devastated, but, you know, it was one of those things. And my younger brother, who worked in the restaurant business as a waiter, said, you should open a restaurant. And I said, well, to be honest, I know nothing about a restaurant. He said, yeah, well, I'm working. I said, yeah, but you can't cook.
Chemistry is just like cooking, or cooking is just like chemistry, Kadeem, surely?
Yes, but the thing is, like, if you're a nation, like, you don't cook at home. The guys who work in restaurants would never cook at home. That's one of the things people don't seem to understand. And even the precious chefs in Pakistan, India, who cook for weddings, we talk about 500-600 people. They would never cook once they got home. So it's something that you pick up. But I said, once we got into the restaurant business, everybody kept saying it's Indian food. I said, no, it's not Indian food. No, it's mixtures. It's Iranian, it's Mediterranean, it's some of it Chinese, all sorts of the mixed up. And they said, they wanted to write a book. Now, I was a trained chemist. My school in Bradford was, you had arts on one side, science on the other, big motorway. Nobody crossed it. And we weren't encouraged to cross it. We had one girl who did, I think, chemistry A level. And we had one guy who did English and literature A level. That was it. Science was for boys, English was for girls. And we were told that English, right, if you did science, you couldn't write a sentence. And I believe that. And if you did sort of literature, you couldn't add two and two. And everyone kept saying, why don't you do a curry? And I did some research. like a scientist, 56, this happened in 1956, 1970, whatever. And I showed it to certain people. So why don't you write from your own point of view? Forget this, right? Go back, right, to your own experience. And this is where I started off the research.
Well, I've got to say, I mean, you talk about, obviously, as you just mentioned there, Middlesbrough, unique, with a population of around about 135,000, it's gone up a little bit since then, consists of 55 different nationalities. The restaurants and fast food outlets on Linthorpe Road and Borough Road reflect the diversity. Food on sale every evening ranges from Indian, Chinese, Arabian, Italian, Greek, French to, of course, McDonald's, KFC, good old fish and chips, and, of course, the Middlesbrough speciality, the Palmo. It's not so much that, but one of the things I was so impressed by, Kadeem, in a text that was written in 2006, you even got a photograph of Linthorpe Road, which looks as though it's just taken right in the midst of lockdown. Nobody there at all, basically. Completely deserted.
That was taken on Sunday.
What was it in 2006 when you actually took that shot? You said, I can predict in 14 years from now, it's going to be complete lockdown.
No, I took that on Sunday morning at about 9 o'clock. And apparently there's nobody there.
Yeah, well, there we are. Who would have thought it would have worked for this? The thing I really like about the text is that you certainly address the way in which the system developed. You talk about the most countries in which, obviously, national curry dishes were developed. And just talk us through that kind of findings, because, I mean, I love the appendix where you actually talk about everything from Moses Carpenter in 1889 to, of course, the onset of the first sort of houses. And I think you talked about the gender issues that were coming through there. I think I was particularly interested in the woman who came across from India, where she'd had a wonderful life in industry in India, but ended up actually working in an environment that effectively was anything but. I mean, it was you know, no garden, no parish. I mean, that whole notion and the experience of the first generation migrants in terms of Middlesbrough that you've actually worked through that. I mean, the hospitality where you talk about Christian traditions saying share your food with a guest, the Muslim tradition states give all the foods to your guests and so on. There's some really interesting things there where I feel as though any one of those would make a motion picture in itself. I mean, was that a joy to research? Was it were you faced with areas that you were disappointed by from that sort of perspective? I mean, the lady I was referring to was actually Ghulam Sawar Khan Chohan, returned to Pakistan in 1947 for an arranged marriage to 16-year-old cousin Nafiz Akhar. And she leaves the wonderful grassy plains of the Punjab with its hot climate and clear blue skies. And after a long sea voyage in 1949 via Liverpool, arrived in food-rationed, cold, grim Middlesbrough. Well, nothing has changed there. Unable to speak a word of English, she sets up home in a gardenless, cold terraced house in Grange Road. That's a big, big culture shock.
Well, to be honest, it was a culture shock to everybody. One of the things that people tend to forget is that most of the people who came to from Pakistan, especially Mirpur in this area, and any industrial area, they came from rural areas. They were not used to cities. And also you come in, right, from being sort of living in open areas. In the summers, we used to sleep on the rooftops, flat rooftops.
You slide green. Off on the slopey roots of Cleveland.
No. This is flat roofs.
Big danger.
So, yeah, and to come into used to be a rural area, to come into something that's industrial, and so you're living sort of in your room in the cold weather. I remember my first experience coming in as a 10-year-old, landed in the Heathrow Airport. This is October 4th, about 8 p.m., or 7 p.m., something like that. It's raining, it's cold, it's windy. And this was when they used to get on the steps of the plane, they walk, there was no tunnels. And this air stewardess looked at me, Asian, obviously. She said, look, she said, the light they call See England, right? And the wind just went straight through me. That was my first experience. And this is sort of the experience of everybody, you know. Yeah. Especially in the middle of winter.
Precisely. I mean, it's also wonderful to see that we've got some wonderful Kadeem Hussain poetry, which is actually in there. Presumably, Dream the Dream is an authentic Kadeem Hussain number?
It is.
Just open up that opening paragraph. Dream the dream, you Lascars, sons of Punjab, northwest frontiers, Gujarat, Kashmir, and Bengal, sitting cross-legged on a charpoy in the shade of a banyan, feasting upon meats fit for Maharajas, lovingly conjured by mother, the best chef in the world. That sort of sense of home, the sort of the line that comes across that. I'm not sure. I mean, Rob, you've read the text as well. It kind of really echoes the sense that actually we have a human experience here, which is unique. And maybe sometimes we were too quick. And indeed, it's one of the sort of aspects that human beings are too quick to make snap judgments and say, oh, they're other, they're strange, they're speaking strange languages. We can't possibly assimilate.
Well, I think that's one of the problems. I have a problem with this thing when the assimilation or integration, right? I hate that when politicians use this because, say, for example, me, right? If they say integrate, I went to school like everybody else. I went to college like everybody else. I used the public transport like everybody else, transport. My kids are going to went to school. My grandkids are going to school. We use the same shop. They have a similar sort of interest to everybody else. So what's this integration business? And when you look at the history of Britain or England, if you like, it's all foreigners. You start from the right beginning. The name England.
It's the Romans. What did the Romans ever do for us? They brought us all the spices. Unbelievable, you know?
Yeah.
Rob, clearly, as say, we mentioned, obviously, you're involved with Fly Me to the Moon, etc. What was it that captured your imagination about going for a curry?
Just the one thing that I realized as soon as I got into the restaurant was that very few people who served in the restaurant spoke good English, or you got the job in the restaurant because you couldn't get a job anywhere else. So when people came in, they couldn't talk to them. They couldn't answer back. They couldn't interview. You know, they couldn't talk to them about any of the topic. And that became the restaurant, Indian restaurant business seen as the very bottom end compared to, say, from a French restaurant or everything else. The other thing, actually, I don't know if I pointed that out or not. Going to a restaurant for working class was made possible by the curry itself. Because before that, most people couldn't afford to go to restaurants. It was expensive. The other thing with these was they were open at the time of the pubs were shutting. So you came in, there's something, they were cheap. Anybody could afford it. And from the early 50s, I believe that if you went to a restaurant, you had your Sunday bests on and everything else. Whereas the restaurant was you staggered out of a pub and you
came to somebody else. The most sort of decorous or indeed sophisticated way of actually sort of working on that basis. Share with us, I mean, two key things that for me, again, really are kind of fundamental to the text. One is, of course, your description of the Manglar Dam, which I must admit I was not familiar with, but also why the Manglar Dam in particular had a major impact in terms of migration of the Mapuri population in particular.
Well, this was during the British rule, there was the plan to irrigate the area. And once the independence came over, there was the problem with the rivers, the five rivers. And it was decided that Pakistan was using three rivers, India was using two rivers, and they built a dam. And the dam is like what I would like to compare with the fact that, you know, the English Union, Scotland, nobody asked Scotland. It was decided by the English Union. It's the same thing. Well, the dam was decided by somebody sat in Karachi. Did not ask the local people. And they came up, the new term they knew was, well, we're building a dam there. And they wanted to move these people out. They wouldn't, because most of them had never been out of their district. And the interesting story, there's a guy who came to England on a ship, jumped ship at Hull, ended up in Midford, then went to live in Newcastle, then went to live in Birmingham, married an English woman, and he kept in touch with all the politicians. And when this came up, there was a military government. The dam was funded by the British government. So everybody wanted to keep hush hush. And he went over and he saw the president at the time, General Yu. He said, what's your problem? He said, the people won't move. He said, well, give them a passport. They need laborers in England. So that's when they came up when they're in areas like Middlesbrough. Then somebody says the parents or grandparents came from Pakistan. 95% came from Meerut.
which of course, again, I mean, we see it, construction began in 1953, the year of coronation, of course. We also, in 1956, had the Suez Canal crisis. So you had the end of empire, pretty much from that point of view, the debacle of the Suez Canal, completed in 1957. And then, of course, proving that it's always wonderful how bureaucrats can actually involve with the whole thing, the 1962 Commonwealth Immigration Act, originally designed to actually restrict immigration, actually has exactly the reverse effect, because it raises the panic barriers and people say, well, we better get in before they actually put anything else into the system.
Yeah, the interesting thing was when people did that, they did this so to get their children education. The idea was they would go back. Even at that time, the idea was you get the kids in there, they'll have a bit of education, and they'll go back. Obviously, the problem is that the goalposts keep moving. The kids who grow up here are British. They don't care what color they are, they're British. You know, their idea that, so it became difficult to go back. And then after that, there was an idea that when I retire, I'll go back. A number of problems. One is all your people you know are here, your family, your kids, your grandkids. And by the time you get to this private age, there's some medical problem that arises. You have to, you know. So do you leave everybody and go there? It's become impossible for anybody to go over.
Absolutely. And again, thankfully, we haven't moved down the line, which is sometimes being mooted by one or two politicians who should remain nameless, of repatriation and various other aspects. So that's a different line entirely. Rob, can I bring you in here? I mean, you've sort of been there. And again, so go back to that original question. If you can actually hear us, Robert, just share with us, what are your own highlights of this particular text? I think Robert might have... Oh, he's there.
From a
good
history point of view... From a history point of view, from Middlesbrough history point of view, the idea that some of these restaurants go back a long way and where they actually were. I remember going to the Bongo Club when I was younger, and to know that the Bongo Club, or that building and the buildings near it, played a big role in the first curry houses in Middlesbrough. That kind of piqued my imagination about and opened it up, and I think what you said earlier, what Kadim said earlier about applies to Middlesbrough as much as this country, that Middlesbrough was built on waves of immigration from the start, because when it was built in 1830, there was only 25 people living here, so everybody came into work, and it was just waves of people coming from all over the world. So it's really interesting to hear this story, and also the northeastern links to the Lascars, which I don't think many people know about. That, Kadim, can you mention that about the Lascars?
Yep. Well, the Lascars were actually, as soon as the port opened, they were coming in. So there's a photograph in the 1890s of sort of the four Lascars looking through the shop window. Nobody's looking at them. No, it's so exotic. They're part of the scenery. You know. So as soon as the port opened, there were Indian sailors, Arab, Chinese coming in.
And continued ever onwards from the sort of the seafaring aspects onwards. Another aspect which Ashok Kumar actually referred to, and I must admit I wasn't aware of this, I mean, obviously lost in time and hopefully quite rightly so, but the Cannon Street riots. And the issue that relates to that, I mean, that's something which obviously you have a clip from the Evening Gazette at the time, really, and clearly a sad aspect of race relations in Middlesbrough, but something which kind of, again, had its echoes in terms of other elements of the late 60s and 50s as well.
Yeah, I think that's one thing. The sad thing I find about that is it's been the way it's been swept under the carpet. Everybody said, we just forget about that. Even the police were saying, well, actually, it wasn't race riots. It was more like a fight with the police and the Cannon Street community. It was race riots. I think the problem with that one was it's never been fully investigated. One of the problems they had, and it's been said, was that it had more to do with the sort of the gangster element than the race riots, because the restaurant itself was set up at the time, and it got trashed a week before it was open. It got trashed completely, then refurbished in the week. And when it opened up, there was a fight with the young guy. Where it came from, some people say it's to do with the protection money. So whether it was truly race riots or not, but certain people took advantage of that. And it's as long as we know somebody's different. And because they had this system that nobody to speak up for them.
Again, something which sadly has its echoes across the basin, and let's hope we don't sort of return to that particular. Obviously, Cannon Street, what was there, is completely gone now, and sort of still exists in time and space in its own way. Let's go back to what we considered at the start here in terms of. It's difficult to identify the first Indian cafe or restaurant in Middlesbrough. There could have been some inns that might have served curry, but the first cafe owner of an Indian connection was Mrs. Mary Hassan, a wife of Ghulam Hassan, in 1934. Took over the dining rooms from Miss M. Hornigold at 3 Bridge Street, West Middlesbrough. It's not known if she served curry. Just talk us through the research that you went into in terms of tracking those names and details down. Was it oral history? Was it details from the Evening Gazette? Was it advertisements? How did you actually use your methodology here?
Well, this was a very difficult research because this is before the social media took off. So this was going through the county archives, looking through the papers, the business directories, reading about anything about the local history, gleaning through everything I could find. Oral history is very difficult because there's very few people you could get hold of to talk about this business. Most of the Asian people in the restaurant business didn't know anything about this. They just knew nothing about the previous history. They'd be more concerned about running their own restaurant. And the other problem we have with the restaurant business is sort of like a formula system. There's one to many that you go into sort of just every restaurant will be similar. Although the method is going to be different, the way they cook the dishes. But the formula is the same sort of menu. But I spent about 5 years getting this researching. And it went through sort of looking through the county archives and reference library. I was lucky at the time, actually. We had a brilliant reference library person, Jenny Parker. She was really great help. And so it's looking through papers, magazines, newspaper, Evening Gazette, Northern Echo.
Traditional pre-Google traditional, research.
The proper research, you know. Go through the microfilm and everything else.
Yeah. As I say, I'm sure that people will be just saying they'll Google that now. So we started off with myths and some of those myth busters. I mean, I did like the line about the hotter the curry is, the better it is, and the notion of actually how you wanted to actually increase the hotness of curry to ensure people to consume more beer, which, of course, is ironic given the non-alcoholic nature of Muslim beliefs in the first place. So all sorts of issues to hand there. Is there going to be a sequel? I mean, this was 2006, so it's now 15 years in terms of the system. Any one of the sort of topics that we've just looked at today, I think, could actually merit its own system. Do you intend to take it any further, or is it a case of no, going for a curry, a social and culinary history, holding it up there, so the whole thing's actually there, will be very much of its time, and it's going to be a little gem that will sit quite neatly in there? Or will you consider doing a digital version of the book to actually make it available online?
I think we've got to redo it again because, as I said, at the time, the social media hadn't taken off. So it's very difficult to get hold of information. Now I can talk to people all over the world. People have moved away. I think I've got to redo this again to bring it up to date, if nothing else. At this moment, as you mentioned, Lintock Road is center of food. There's this Indian, Chinese, Mexico, you name it, we've got everything. For a small town, and I think the fact that we've lost all the industry, the interest is gone. When I moved into this area in 1975, there was sort of British Steel, ICI, number of shipyards, the number of foundries was unbelievable. Mind you, most of the time, the area was covered in smog. You couldn't see anything, especially in the winters. I'll be doing something to update this. I have to because I want to bring it up to date.
Well, as you say yourself, in terms of the motto of the actual town itself, Arimus, which kind of echoes the whole notion that you might have thought that this whole town could become a ghost town. It's still hanging on in there. Admittedly, the team with Neil Warnock, you know, a key sort of, you know, key fan of the borough, and did regular contributions to Fly Me to the Moon, the fanzine, also sort of echo on that. Can people still get hold of course, the original text Going for a Curry, though? Can they still purchase it in any way, shape or form online?
Yes, they can, actually. There's still... what we probably have is we only did 500, and we're getting very close
collector's
to
500.
Collector's editions. I think there's only about 20 left.
Well, in which case, collector's editions for eBay, obviously, on that system. I was privileged that Rob actually lent his copy through the system for myself. But it makes sense. And I'm sure, again, you've opened up a whole range of aspects there. And did you take all the photographs yourself?
No, I did actually. There's one or two I found out because looking through the research. The Paradise Cafe, that came in. I was doing research, and this guy came and said, "What are you doing? I'm doing curries." He said, "Why do I need some photographs?" And I was taking pubs, but I saw this at the Paradise, and I took a photograph. I said, "Can I have one, please?" So that's when I got the photograph. But now I said, now it would be easier because of social media. You can put in sort of the old members of Midwest, that's the thing. You talk to a lot of people. Before that, there was no social media. I did put it up in the newspaper. Very little reply from Northern Apple.
Yeah, it's old school. It's so last century, the newspaper. You know, you want some TikTok dancers, Kadeem. That's what you want. A bit of TikTok.
Yeah, but the
was the only thing. That's the key
the thing. The time's the only way to research.
It's extraordinary. Again, really impressive text. First time I was privileged to actually read it. Really found it quite fascinating. Rob, how does this fit in with, obviously, your Authors of the Month? I mean, it's going into our Author of the Month package that we'll be doing and you're listening to as far as Southside Broadcasting is concerned. How does it fit into your own local history viewpoints?
Well, we're going to show this... recorded version of this or listen to this as part of the
you can have the video if you wish. I don't mind. I'll hold up the
link.
Obviously we just see Robert Nichols because he's actually gone quiet. He switched his camera off. Obviously he just wants to be anonymous.
I think we'll start talking about football. Yeah, I'll be more interested.
Very thankful for this being a contribution to Local History Month, because it's Middlesbrough and Stockton this year, and this is something that we've, I've never included Kadim and Curry, the story of Curry and going for a curry before, and we need it in there, don't we? We definitely need it in there.
And I've got to ask the question, Rob, what's your favourite curry? Are you a spicy curry person? Are you a non-spicy person? Where would you go for?
Yeah, I'm not that spicy. I like a korma or something like that. Mm. But... I had a curry on Saturday, and I'm looking forward to the time when I can actually go inside and not just take out.
It was clearly celebrating Borough's second back-to-back win, basically, which is always good against Sheffield Wednesday. You
know, can I just say, Rob's comment about korma? The story of korma is that it was invented by the chef for the Mongol emperor, and he wanted to have a moonlight dinner with his favorite wife on white. And he said, "What I want is all food white." So they had musicians, blindfolded musicians playing, white sheets, and everything had to be white. That's where the korma, it was made with the yogurt, ground almonds and nuts. That's where the korma came in, not what you eat in the restaurants today.
Precisely. And what's your own favorite curry, Kadeem?
Mine has to be something like a Buna, just below Madras, so you can taste all the spices. Once it becomes hot, right, burns your mouth, you don't need to taste anything. It loses the point.
Absolutely. Kadeem Hussain, huge thanks for taking time out for today in this Local History Month. Again, Going for a Curry, a social and culinary history. Keep your eye out for that. There are only a few actually left in terms of text, etc. But we have had the promise there from the author himself. He will actually be producing an updated version, which I'm sure will be online and available in the not too distant future.
Thanks very much, Alex. Pleasure anytime.